Texas, America, and the world. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. After the first commercial break, we're going to be joined by Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find Jim's website at 911scholars.org. We're going to be speaking with him for 3 hours about 9/11, what we know about it, what we don't know about it, and where things seem to be headed in the days forthcoming in regard to interpreting the events that took place on September the 11th, 2001. Number of items today in the news: Ted Pike from the National Prayer Network sends out an alert on Henry Waxman's speech control bill subverting democracy. The Times Online in London has a story about the KGB and the plot to taint the so-called Nazi Pope, Pope Pius the 12th. The Kavkaz Center in Chechnya sends me an update entitled U.S. Funds Terror Groups to Sow Chaos in Iran. We've been talking about that in terms of Azerbaijan province. We've been talking about it in terms of the Kurds. We've been speaking of it in terms of Khuzestan province and Balochistan province in Iran. Now comes forth the story from the Kavkaz Center in Chechnya to the effect that in all of these regional locations of Iran, there are things going on that suggest that something is afoot. The International Telegraph of Britain tells us that Iran is poised to strike in wealthy Gulf states. It's a post from yesterday. The D.C. Anti-War Network sends me information about a March 12th protest coming up. That's just 3 days from now. And that protest is going to involve the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. Keep an eye on that. I've contacted the coordinator of that protest, Carol Moore, to see if she would not be interested in coming on this show to talk specifically about what they hope to achieve with this March 12th activity. And the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, the AP-UPI of the World Jewish Community, has a story entitled Obama to IPAC, the military option is open against Iran. So Barack Obama is apparently competing with Hillary Clinton and John Edwards to see who can be the most pro-Israel and the most warlike in rhetoric, leading up to the time frame when it may appear that the United States could quite possibly engage in a preemptive military strike against Tehran. Here's a story that finally comes out as of the Washington Post yesterday, page A16, by Daphna Linzer, entitled Former Iranian Defense Official Talks to Western Intelligence. We'd been speaking about the fact that Ali Reza Asghari had disappeared on the 7th of February in Istanbul, Turkey. A lot of questions as to his whereabouts and who had him and why. But now it comes forth in yesterday's Washington Post that he is allegedly cooperating with Western intelligence agencies. He's a former Iranian deputy defense minister who once commanded the Revolutionary Guard, once had heavy connections in Lebanon on behalf of the Iranian regime, allegedly was heavily involved in the so-called founding of Hezbollah. According to a senior U.S. official, when Ali Reza Asghari disappeared last month during a visit to Turkey, he was doing so voluntarily. Voluntarily, folks. No suggestion here on the part of the United States or Israel that Ali Reza Asghari was kidnapped. But Iranian officials are suggesting, of course, that he may well have been kidnapped by either Israel or the United States. The U.S. official said that Asghari is willingly cooperating. He did not divulge Asghari's whereabouts or specify who is questioning him, according to the Washington Post, but made clear that the information Asghari is offering is fully available to U.S. intelligence. Asghari served in the Iranian government until early 2005 under then-President Mohammad Khatami. Asghari's background suggests that he would have deep knowledge of Iran's national security infrastructure, conventional weapons arsenal, and ties to Hezbollah in South Lebanon. And again, as we look at it, the Israelis are denying that they were involved in orchestrating his disappearance. The United States says that Asghari's disappearance is voluntary. He's being questioned by someone. Bush's NSC is not returning calls for comment. No one seems to know where Asghari is. We'll be back with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Stay tuned.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly.
American Free Press.
AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49. Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
Gold, ever climbing, as the dollar continues to spiral into a free fall. How long before it hits rock bottom? Between 1800 and 1913, the value of the dollar was more or less constant. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the value of the dollar has depreciated 97%. Due to global inflationary policies and the continued erosion of the U.S. dollar, gold and silver are still in the early stages of the greatest bull market the world has ever seen. Whether you purchase precious metals to stabilize your portfolio or you're looking for strong growth, gold and silver will provide you with both. Don't you owe it to yourself to do business with Republic Trading Group? Call us today and become a part of the raging bull in gold and silver. 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898. Call now. 1-800-691-7898.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We would like to greet our new conventional affiliate, WMQM AM 1600 in Memphis, Tennessee. That's a 50,000-watt station that's going to be bringing Mark Dankos, America, and the Republic Broadcasting Network to a much wider conventional radio audience in the American South, even as we continue to expand our outreach on the Internet and also in international shortwave. Today we're joined by Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find Jim's website at 911scholars.org. That's 911scholars.org. And reading directly from the front page of that website, it says that the propaganda by the government and the corporate media would have us believe that the 9/11 inside job hypothesis is not merely controversial but unsupported by proof. That is wrong. Academics, experts, and scholars who have examined the physical evidence and considered this event within its historical context tend to converge in agreement that the inside job hypothesis is, in fact, strongly supported by the available evidence, while the version advanced in the 9/11 Commission report is not only false, but provably false, and in crucial respects, physically impossible. That the official account of 9/11 is a lie, and that 9/11 appears to have been an inside job is no longer a matter of serious scientific debate. And as you look at the Scholars for 9/11 Truth website and read the front page here, it indicates that there's going to be a conference held in mid to late July in Madison, Wisconsin. That conference is entitled The Science of 9/11, What's Controversial and What's Not. Jim, how are you this morning?
Just fine, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, I must confess, I am a relative newcomer to this topic. Now, I have seen references made to Stephen Jones' research and some of what Morgan Reynolds has written on the topic. It seems to me that what we're speaking of here is a situation where the scientific and the political both come into play at this particular juncture. But suffice it to say that, you know, a year or two ago, I would have had a lot of trouble processing the fact that 9/11 could have been an inside job. And yet, nonetheless, when I look at your material, it's highly convincing. I also notice Christopher Ketchum's piece in Counterpunch yesterday entitled, What Did Israel Know in Advance of the 9/11 Attacks? So some of the things that your organization has been on top of from the beginning are things that are only now starting to creep into places where mere whispers about all of this would have been considered out of bounds even 12 to 18 months ago. Where do you think all this is headed?
Boy, that's a great question, Mark. Our efforts as a research organization has been to expose falsehoods and reveal truths about 9/11 and to publish that information, get it out to the American people, and in the confidence that the American people, when they are fortified with knowledge about what actually happened on 9/11, will be in the position to take appropriate steps. For some time, I have hoped that district attorneys and attorneys general in the various states affected here, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and especially New York, might open grand jury proceedings and process some of the evidence that we have uncovered, where I'd be delighted to take steps to provide expert testimony by various of our members, and that something might proceed in a legal venue that would be appropriate to the seriousness of this case.
Well, you know, as I evaluate this whole thing, Jim, I'm old enough, of course, to remember the Kennedy assassination. And my father was an Air Force colonel at the time that event happened. We were stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. I was in the third grade. And, of course, for a period of years thereafter, I would occasionally hear these whispers that there was something wrong with the Warren Report's analysis of what transpired, just on the basis of the ballistics and the scientific case alone. And, of course, for years, as a young person growing up, I was hearing, of course, from my parents and from others who tended to trust our government, that all of this talk was merely designed to undermine the faith of the American people in their government, that there was undoubtedly no more to this Kennedy thing than what the Warren Commission had said. And yet I remember when I was in college at Valparaiso University that the African-American comedian Dick Gregory showed me, this would have been in 1975, a copy of the Zapruder film, where I saw things on that film, particularly frame 313, which didn't seem to correspond at all to what the government had indicated in 1964 in the Warren Report. Well, now fast forward to the present time, and in recent years, when I have come across these allegations from Stephen Jones, formerly of Brigham Young University, and then Morgan Reynolds, formerly of both the Bush administration and, I understand, a highly respected professor from Texas A&M, talking about the fact that there is something wrong scientifically alone with this 9/11 report, I found myself going back to the experience I had in college with Dick Gregory and thinking to myself, gee, the profiles of the people saying these things indicate that, one, they've got academic credentials, and, two, they're not crazy. And if they and if those two things are true, maybe this whole subject needs to be revisited with more of an open mind. Do you find yourself being involved in the forefront of opening more people's minds to the fact that we're not talking about crackpottery here, but serious academic research that is casting grave doubt on what actually happened 6 years ago?
Oh, you're absolutely right. We have brought together a group of experts and students and scholars with backgrounds and expertise in many different disciplines related to these issues, including physicists, mechanical engineers, civil engineers, structural engineers, pilots, aeronautical engineers. I think that our findings, which are summarized, for example, in the pieces entitled Why Doubt 9/11 that you can find at the very top of the menu bar on 911scholars.org, are very telling, even devastating to the government's position, because there we enumerate some 20 different reasons that provide disproof of the government's account. Anyone who's interested in the wide range of military intelligence and government officials, not to mention prominent Americans and professors in various disciplines, should just check the yellow box at the top left of the menu bar, where you're going to find a very impressive list of individuals. I think the claims that have lied beneath the government's attempt to defend itself really have been tattered and torn, because the those who are advancing these views are not only very substantial people with considerable accomplishment and expertise, but the reasons that we are offering are perfectly objective and scientific grounds that show that in virtually every significant respect what the government has told us about 9/11 is false. I'm intrigued, Mark, by the way, with your interest in JFK. I devoted a huge amount of my life to the investigation of the death of JFK in collaboration with the best qualified individuals to ever study the case. And we have indeed found that the government's account in that instance was, like the case of 9/11, based in many instances on impossibilities, physical phenomena that can't take place, which not only extend to the magic bullet theory, where it turns out that the official trajectory of a bullet entering the base of the back of the neck and exiting the throat after passing through without hitting any bony structures is anatomically impossible because cervical vertebrae intervene, but the conclusion that the president was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets is inconsistent with the alleged assassin having used a Mannlicher Carcano, which is not a high-velocity weapon. Which means that if the official medical account about the kind of bullets that impacted the body is true, then Lee Oswald cannot have been the assassin, much less an assassin here. And in addition, we have discovered multiple indications that Lee Oswald wasn't even on the sixth floor, but rather was on the second floor drinking a Coke, where he was observed by co-workers at 11:45, at 12:15, as late as 12:25, before the assassination took place at 12:30. And then
including, as I understand it, the secretary to the president of the book depository placed Oswald there as late as 12:25.
The executive assistant to the vice president, you're exactly right. And then within 90 seconds of the assassination, he was confronted there by Marion Baker, who held him, who was a motorcycle patrolman, who held him in his sights until Roy Truly, the supervisor, came along and assured him that this man belonged there. They both wrote in their statements, which were published, their handwritten statements were published in the Warren Report, that he looked calm, wasn't perspiring, not agitated, seemed perfectly normal, except Roy Truly added, he was a bit startled, as anyone might be, to suddenly find themselves confronted by a revolver being held on them by a police officer. And the police officer added he was drinking a Coke.
Yes.
So the scenario is really quite bizarre, you know, the idea that the most the successful assassin in history would rush across a warehouse on the sixth floor stash as trusty Mannlicher Carcano raced down four floors to a lunchroom in order, what, to have a Coke. Just, you know, the commercial possibilities are almost endless. You envision Lee Oswald staying there with his Mannlicher Carcano in one hand and his bottle of Coke in the other, saying things really do go better.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, looking at the Kennedy case, just as a microcosm of the issues that I think you open up for us again in terms of 9/11, the complete discrepancies between the Parkland Hospital physicians in regard to the character of Kennedy's wounds, with the official story that came out of the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, where you had an autopsy being supervised by a gentleman who was not even a forensic pathologist. And so you have two completely different accounts of the whole issue of entry and exit wounds, the whole question of the mechanical firing time that would have been necessary for the Mannlicher Carcano, whole series of other things that suggest that what happened in 1963 might well be repeated today, in the process of being repeated, in regard to this whole issue of 9/11. We'll be back with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth when Mark Dankoff's America returns from San Antonio on RBN. Stay tuned.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly.
American Free Press.
AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49. Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
It's true. Gold and silver have been a source of true wealth for years. In fact, people around the world have used these metals to buy and sell goods for over 5,000 years. And gold and silver will continue to be a source of true wealth for the foreseeable future. If you look back in history, you'll see that all fiat currencies have failed to maintain wealth or failed altogether. But gold has always protected its holder, a true asset, usable to anyone around the globe. As the value of your Federal Reserve note continues to depreciate, gold will be your only insurance. As an example, in 1975, you could buy a $40,000 home with 1,000 gold coins. Today, that same house is $400,000, yet you can still buy it with 1,000 gold coins. To find out more information on how to protect your wealth, call Republic Trading at 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit, the right strategies can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We're joined today until 10 o'clock Central Standard Time by Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find this incredible website at 9/11scholars, scholarsplural.org. That's 9/11scholars.org. I'm going to be posting information on this show at Breaking All the Rules News, the web's leading paleoconservative website, with a link to Jim's website so that all of the browsers of BATR News might have a chance to take a look at this incredible repository of information. Before Jim and I get back into 9/11, I was just going to mention on the air that in terms of the Kennedy assassination as a potential political precursor to what we're now dealing with 9/11, I remember when I was back going to school in Philadelphia at Westminster Theological Seminary, doing some postgraduate work there, that in May of 2001, I ran into a guy in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, by the name of Ed Reed, R-E-I-D. This is about 6 months after I completed my third-party run for the U.S. Senate with the Constitution Party in the state of Delaware. And as it turns out, in my conversations with Ed Reed, he proved to be the medical corpsman at the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland, who took the autopsy photographs of the body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy on that fateful weekend. And Ed Reed, in a conversation with me, amplified a little bit on some things that he said to David Lifton, who wrote the book Best Evidence. The noteworthy points that Mr. Reed made were, number one, that the photographs that he took that day of the president's body were never introduced to the Warren Commission, as number one. And number two, the official conclusions of the autopsy conducted at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland and supervised by non-forensic pathologist James Humes had a series of conclusions based upon those photographs that were never shown to the Warren Commission that were taken by Mr. Reed that had a completely different version and spin on those events than what Mr. Reed saw that day himself when he took the pictures. He's had to live with that, of course, for lo these many, many years since. And it suggests, again, that what happened in 1963, in terms of the political implications, may have some bearing upon the way we now look at 9/11. Jim, I was going to ask you, in terms of yourself and the other scholars that are involved with 911scholars.org, I'm aware of the fact that Stephen Jones apparently lost his job at Brigham Young University for airing some of this evidence and for giving, in the case of Dr. Jones, his honest opinion about what he thought that evidence pointed to. To what extent has his sad story been repeated by other people, other scholars that you know of?
Well, there are at least four across the country who have encountered difficulties on just as a result of their investigation in 9/11. It's a fellow named William Woodward at the University of New Hampshire, a psychologist who's been criticized by the Republican governor of that state and a Republican senator. There's Judy Wood, who's a professor of mechanical engineering with degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and materials engineering science, who, in my opinion, is the most qualified person in relation to the study of the physical properties of the events in New York City, who was not renewed, not tenured by Clemson University, and she's confident, as am I, that it was as a result of her research. You mentioned Stephen Jones, who was put on an early retirement track as a consequence of BYU's desire not to be associated with his research on 9/11. And in addition, there's Kevin Barrett, who has been right here in Madison, where I now reside, who was teaching a course on Islam that came under fire because he had a 1 week of a 15-week course in which he discussed 9/11 and its impact on the Islamic community, on the Muslim world, where he discussed conflicting interpretations, and he was criticized severely by a state legislator by the name of Stephen Nass, by the Republican candidate for governor, Mark Green, and even by the governor of the state, Jim Doyle, who's a pretty good Democratic governor. But the university, in that instance, stood by him. They reviewed his course, determined it was very appropriate. He received good teaching reviews and so forth. And I'm proud of the University of Wisconsin for having stood fast.
Yes, and, you know, as you look at this, it gets back again to what I remember as a boy in the 1960s when Mark Lane came out with his book, Rush to Judgment. Of course, in those days, as a young kid, I wasn't reading that sort of thing, but I heard about the book, and I heard a lot of ad hominem attacks against Lane at that particular time, that he was a pinko, maybe a communist, that he was just someone interested in selling a few books and stirring up a controversy without any evidence. And, of course, the people who were saying this were, by and large, in my judgment now, people who had not read the book, or who had read the book and perhaps found some of the argumentation in it to be airtight enough that they really didn't want to deal with the consequences of coming to the conclusion that Lane had some viable things to say. And then, of course, the other aspect in the strategy was simply to debunk anyone who wanted to examine Lane's claims. as people who had an inherent anti-government bias or an anti-American bias or radical left political persuasions and this kind of stuff. And now, to some extent, it seems to me that when you watch the coverage of this 9/11 thing that we get routinely with Fox News, there's a very strong element of this today simply to engage in ad hominem attacks against people like Barrett and Wood and Stephen Jones and yourself, but also to suggest that anyone who's interested, as I would be, in encountering these sources and encountering the evidence and listening to what's being said, that we who are the listeners and the learners tend to be categorized with this groupthink mentality as well.
Well, you make nice points. As early as 1 April 1967, the CIA had issued a dispatch to its agents on giving advice about how to counter criticism of the Warren Report. And, you know, Mark Lane was a subject of all of those. You're supposed to suggest that they're wedded to theories adopted before the evidence was in, that they're politically interested, that they're financially interested, that they're hasty and inaccurate in their research, that they're infatuated with their own theories. None of this is true of Mark Lane or David Lifton or Harold Weisberg or Sylvia Marr or many of the other early students of the case. In fact, it's astonishing to me how right they were in many respects, because a lot of the evidence that disproves, for example, the magic bullet theory included the holes in the shirt and the jacket that he was wearing. A diagram from the autopsy report that all of these align and show a wound to the body about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. And the FBI agent named Siebert, who was present at the autopsy, showed a wound to the back lower than the wound to the throat. We have the president's personal physician's autopsy, the death certificate. This is Admiral George Berkeley, who described it as at the level of the third thoracic vertebrae, this wound to the back, which is the same, about 5.5 inches below the collar. And we even have the mortician's description of the wounds the president suffered, which included 1 5 to 6 inches below the collar. This has been resurrected by the recent release of some video footage that's alleged to have been laying dormant in somebody's closet all these years, that shows a part of the motorcade where the leading apologist for the Warren Commission, Gerald Posner, seized upon it and wrote an op-ed piece that was published in the New York Times, in which he claimed that you could see the president's jacket bunched up, which is supposed to account for why the wound, although hitting at the base of the back of the neck, would appear on the shirt and jacket to be much lower. But while if that were true, and I believe, in fact, that the evidence in its totality suggests that this film has been doctored to create that bunched-up appearance, it might account for why the hole would be in the shirt and the jacket, but it certainly wouldn't account for why there'd be these reports of a wound 5.5 inches below the collar that would correspond to the holes in the shirt and the jacket, unless the shirt and the jacket actually were properly aligned. Jack, of course, wore custom tailored clothing. It's very unlikely that his shirt or jacket would bunch very much under practically any conditions. And this is really quite a ridiculous claim, especially when you combine it with David W. Mantic, MD, PhD's finding by taking a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions and creating a CAT scan and determining that the trajectory is not even anatomically possible, that Gerald Posner should be resurrecting. This is really a bit much. Not only that, Mark, but we know that the description of the wound was changed by Gerald Ford, who was then a junior member of the commission, who had the words used to describe it changed from his uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck, to make it more plausible when confronted with documents that showed he had done this. Gerald Ford candidly conceded that he had, but insisted it wasn't in behalf of a conspiracy theory, but to make the historical record more accurate. Well, no one would suggest it was on behalf of a conspiracy theory, but it was part of a conspiracy to cover up what actually happened to our 35th president.
Yes, and looking at the role of both Ford and Arlen Specter in that whole thing, gives us, I think, a microcosm, again, of a much larger problem when it comes to the issue of governmental investigations and propositional truth and the freedom to question official investigations when there's credible data that suggests that it should be questioned, and also what was certainly the failure of corporate news media in the 1960s to cover this Kennedy thing with any degree of integrity. And now it would seem to me that we're running into that same situation now with 9/11, which brings us full circle to Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Jim, what do you see as the basic scientific evidence in the 9/11 situation that underscores the fact that, in your judgment, the 9/11 Commission report, quoting your website here, is not only false, but provably false, and in crucial respects, physically impossible? Take us through that a little bit.
Those are great questions, Mark. Let me just preface it by observing that just as Arlen Specter played a crucial role in obfuscating the evidence in the investigation of the death of JFK, so Philip Zelikow, who became the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, played a similar role in relation to 9/11. Zelikow came from the inner sanctum of the Bush administration. He oversaw the transition of the national security apparatus from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. He'd co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. And get this, I was so stunned when I discovered this that I put the page that described it up on Scholars, which you can find if you scroll down to a discussion about Wikipedia. It turns out this guy is not only not a scientist and not an historian, Mark, he's actually an expert on the creation and manipulation of political myths. I mean, myths. Can you believe it? I mean, this is what this guy does.
So he's a spin doctor.
He's a spin doctor, and he appears to have been the massively managing force with regard to the investigation of 9/11. He micromanaged most of the subcommittees that were involved in the commission's investigation, and he was the principal author of the 9/11 Commission report, the very report that we're about to address with regard to its massive inadequacies in relation to logic and evidence. But he wrote something that is very inspiring. You know, he wrote something that's very inspiring. For example, a chapter on the horror and the heroism of the day of 9/11 is around 50 pages long, and it's almost exclusively devoted to the first responders and how heroic they were and how they risked their lives and sometimes lost them on behalf of saving persons from these burning buildings. But the amount of information that's contained there about the actual physics of what happened, to describe, you know, the buildings, the fires, the planes, and so forth, is incredibly sketchy. In fact, you could reduce it to two relatively short paragraphs, where in relation to the Twin Towers, for example, it basically asserts that the planes hit the towers and that the resulting fires caused the steel to weaken, and bringing about a pancake collapse. And in the most important sentence in the whole chapter, on page 305, it asserts that the South Tower came down in 10 seconds. Well, it turns out those are inconsistent principles. If you had a pancake collapse, you couldn't have the building come down in 10 seconds. We're talking about a building collapsing through its path of greatest resistance. I mean, people tend to forget that was a massive, very solid building. It was magnificent in its construction. There were 47 core columns, and then there were 240 additional external support columns. John Skilling, who was the senior partner in the engineering firm that put up the building, said even before its construction that it was going to be so solid that it could support 2,000% its normal or expected live load. That means it could support 20 times what you might expect to have to support in terms of office furniture, human beings, everything else that might go into the building. So this is an extremely robust building. Not only that, but Frank DeMartini, who was the project manager on the construction, observed before 9/11, he actually lost his life when these events took place, that the intricate lattice structure and the 47 core columns created such sophisticated load redistribution capabilities that even the impact of multiple multiple aircraft on the building would have negligible effect. He compared it to sticking pencils through mosquito netting. The plane for that it was designed to withstand the impact of was a Boeing 707, which turns out to be very similar in its mass and configuration and fuel load to the 767s that actually hit the building. In fact, the normal cruise speed of the 707 is higher than that of a 767, which implies that it would probably have hit with a greater impact than a 767. The damage done by the planes was interesting, too, because in terms of the North Tower, which was hit first but oddly enough fell second, it was more or less in the center of the 96th floor, where it might be expected to take out some of those core columns. The fire actually burned longer than would be the case in the South Tower, which was hit on the corner of the 80th floor. Perhaps as few as one of those core columns might have been clipped. But the fact is that most of the fuel in those planes burned up in those spectacular fireballs. I mean, if anyone wants to know, you know, how much might have been left, just take a cup of gasoline and pour it out and try to light part of it. I mean, since all that fuel was, contiguous, it was all going up, or the vast majority of it was going up in that first 10 or 15 seconds. So after you had that psychological hit, there really wasn't a whole lot left to bring about these fires. Now, what's fascinating from a scientific point of view is that while some descriptions even have suggested that the steel melted, the melting point of steel is 2,800 degrees, and the highest temperature you can attain with a jet fuel-based fire, where jet fuel is basically kerosene, isn't greater than 1,800 degrees, even when it's fed pure oxygen. In other words, under ideal conditions, you can't get higher than 1,800 degrees with a jet fuel-based fire, which is 1,000 degrees too low to cause the steel to melt. Obviously, the steel did not melt. Moreover, Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel used in the building, which included the trusses, which were these steel beams that connected the core columns to the external perimeter columns, for up to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours. And yet the fires that actually were burning in those buildings, which were oxygen-starved or oxygen-deprived, as indicated, among other reasons, by the billowing black smoke, were estimated by virtually all sides to not have burned higher than around 500 degrees, although there were a couple of hot spots, for example, in the South Tower of 1,300 or 1,400 degrees. The fires actually were burning overwhelmingly too low to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt, and too briefly. I mean, since Underwriters certified the steel for 3 to 4 hours, I mean, here you had in the South Tower burning less than an hour, in the North, less than an hour and a half. If one of those buildings were going to collapse, it should have been the North Tower, not the South Tower, and yet they collapsed in the wrong order, which is a gross disproof of the government's account anyway. And it turns out, Mark, and this is astonishing, too, based on my discussions with structural engineers, these kind of massive heavy steel buildings that include more than 100,000 tons of steel with all these redundant features, and they're welded together and so forth. I mean, it's really a tight package here that, as I mentioned, can support, you know, a huge amount of weight as its carrying capacity, aren't even susceptible to collapse at all unless you have the simultaneous collapse of all those supporting columns. There's no reason that should have happened here because the fires were so modest and because they were irregularly distributed. They weren't uniform. They didn't cover the whole floors. Steel's a terrific thermal conductor, which means if you heat up a part of it, that heat is rapidly dissipated to other parts of the structure. Stop and think about it. Most of those 110-story buildings were stone-cold steel, retaining all of its support capacity. There's no way in the world those buildings could have collapsed, as the government claims. I like to draw a parallel with the Eiffel Tower, because there you can see from the base how much more massive it is. In the case of the Twin Towers, the core columns were 4 inches thick at the base and then tapered off to a quarter inch at the top. That means in terms of their structural or carrying capacity, they were very analogous to, even though they didn't look like, the Eiffel Tower. Would anyone imagine in their wildest dreams if a plane hit the top of the Eiffel Tower and a fire broke out that the Eiffel Tower would collapse? It's an absurd scenario, and yet that's what the government's trying to foist up off on us. It isn't even physically possible. And in fact, what's going on, Mark, is very, very different and very challenging to sort out, because while they seem to begin with something like a conventional collapse in the North Tower, for example, you can see the towers start to descend. Those buildings are actually being blown apart by some massive source of energy. They're being largely pulverized. About 80% of the building is being turned into very fine dust by some enormous source of energy, and that includes the concrete flooring structure that was about 5 inches thick, the desks, the chairs, the computers, the human beings and other living things. They're being converted into very fine dust faster than free fall. If you actually dropped a grand piano, say, off of one of those buildings, it would take perhaps 12 to 13 seconds before it hit the ground, and yet, even by the government's own account, these buildings were destroyed in about 10 seconds apiece. Well, that's a phenomenon that precludes the possibility that they collapse, because a collapse would be under gravitational attraction. They actually were being destroyed faster than free fall, which is another physical impossibility if you accept the government's account. Okay. Well, it's also...
I'm here. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, looking at this whole thing on your website then, Jim, that says that the World Trade Center was intentionally demolished by a high-energy causal process physically unrelated to plane crashes and resulting fires. So what do you think this high-energy causal process was? And in terms of an intentional demolition utilizing this high-energy causal process, what is your best estimate as to who and what was behind these intentional demolitions?
Well, there's a huge amount of additional evidence here, Mark. For example, William Rodriguez, who was the senior custodian in the North Tower, had a group of custodians in a meeting there when a massive explosion occurred in the sub-basement level. It was quite extensive, quite powerful. One of his fellow custodians had virtually all the skin ripped off of his body. And William reported that the explosion in the sub-basement actually occurred even before the plane hit the building. Now, two members of scholars were fascinated by this. Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross undertook an investigation because Columbia University maintained seismographs that recorded disturbances of 0.7 and 0.9 at about the time the planes hit the building. The FAA has very exact information, including radar data, about when the planes actually impacted with those buildings. And they discovered that these sub-basement phenomena, the effects of these explosions in the sub-basements, actually occurred as much as 14 and 17 seconds before the planes hit the building. Now, that's such a stunning indication of complicity by other forces, you know, and one has to ask who could actually bring this about. They published a paper that I have on our website entitled Seismic Proof 9/11 Was an Inside Job, which you can find if you scroll down on the left-hand side. It's a terrific piece that I think provides, you know, conclusive evidence that this didn't happen the way we have been told, but that there were previously positioned explosives, in particular in the sub-basement level. This is all complemented, Mark, by the way, by the collapse, which was a bona fide collapse of Building 7, which is a 47-story, very remarkable skyscraper. That was a couple of 100 feet away from the North and the South Tower. That didn't occur until 5:20 in the afternoon. It was not hit by any planes. It had no jet-based fuel fires. It only had a couple of very modest fires. It was an extremely robustly constructed building because it was erected over two massive power substations providing electricity for lower Manhattan. So you couldn't. They took great pains to make sure this building would never collapse. I mean, hurricane-resistant, earthquake-resistant, the whole bit, Building 7. And yet it came down after a conversation between Larry Silverstein, who had leased the World Trade Center, with somebody he knew as the Ur Fire Commander, and you get this verbal pause because he actually recounted this conversation for a PBS interview, and we have it archived on our website, where he said he told the fire commander that there'd been so much death and destruction, perhaps the best thing to do was to pull it. He said they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building come down. It shows all the signs of a classic controlled demolition. It's a symmetrical collapse. It's at the rate approximately of free fall. In 6.5 seconds, this 47-story building came down into its own basement. You can see this characteristic little kink just to the left of the side of the building in some footage, because they take out one major support section a little bit early so that it'll tend to, you know, implode or collapse toward itself in the center rather than outward. It's a perfect example of controlled demolition. Dan Rather and Peter Jennings on the scene compared it to the destruction of casinos and resorts in Las Vegas, which happens all the time when they're rebuilding them. And, in fact, it's been inexplicable. The National Institute of Standards and Technology has been unable to explain what happened to Building 7, and yet all of the evidence is overwhelming and massive and obvious that this was a conventional controlled demolition, unlike the Twin Towers, which appear to have involved unconventional modes of demolition. I mean, just to illustrate one obvious example, in the case of the Building 7, you see all the floors collapsing at the same time. In the case of the Twin Towers, all the floors were sitting there patiently waiting for their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in the memorable words of Morgan Reynolds. Now, get this, Mark, you're not going to believe what I'm about to say, but about a week ago, archival footage from the BBC turned up, and it's made a tremendous impact in the 9/11 research community, but it hasn't made its way into the mass media, which astounds me considering its significance, where the BBC, we have BBC footage of a reporter explaining that the Solomon Brothers building, and they were occupants in the Building 7 along with the CIA, the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and other important tenants, that Solomon Brothers building had collapsed, and she's making this report 23 minutes before the building actually collapses, and you can see the building over her left shoulder, Mark. It's astounding.
Boy, I tell you, this is dealing truly with the realm of Orwell. We'll be back with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth when Mark Dankos America returns live from San Antonio on RBN. Stay tuned.
The Idaho Observer is one of the last independent American presses and isn't afraid to print the truth. The Idaho Observer is a monthly 24-page hard copy newspaper in its fifth year of addressing important issues affecting all freedom-loving Americans. If you are concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you, then subscribe to the Idaho Observer. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues. Idaho Observer readers receive vital insight into events as they unfold. Our articles editorially emphasize activism and serve as a networking tool for like-minded individuals determined to make a difference. The Idaho Observer, printing what you need to be fully informed on issues that matter to real Americans. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307. That's 208-255-2307.
Sit back, relax, and enjoy a vacation to the beautiful Ozark Mountains. Howard Creek Resort is nestled conveniently between the cities of Bull Shoals and Mountain Home on Bull Shoals Lake in the natural state of Arkansas. Howard Creek Resort offers easy access to excellent fishing and water recreation of all types. The excitement of nearby Branson music shows and Silver Dollar City is accented perfectly by the many attractions located here in the heart of the Ozarks. Horseback riding, water skiing, scuba diving, hiking, caves, and rock climbing are just a few of the many activities that are available to do in our area. Howard Creek Resorts offers it all. Whether you're staying for the weekend or for a month, Howard Creek Resorts is the place to be, an excellent place to stay, and a valued traditional family vacation resort. Visit our website at www.howardcreek.com or call 1-877-253-7690. Come visit us for a lifetime of memories. Sit back, relax, and enjoy a vacation to the beautiful Ozark Mountains. Howard Creek Resort is nestled conveniently between the cities of Bull Shoals and Mountain Home on Bull Shoals Lake in the natural state of Arkansas. Howard Creek Resort offers easy access to excellent fishing and water recreation of all types. The excitement of nearby Branson music shows and Silver Dollar City is accented perfectly by the many attractions located here in the heart of the Ozarks. Horseback riding, water skiing, scuba diving, hiking, caves, and rock climbing are just a few of the many activities that are available to do in our area. Howard Creek Resorts offers it all. Whether you're staying for the weekend or for a month, Howard Creek Resorts is the place to be, an excellent place to stay, and a valued traditional family vacation resort. Visit our website at www.howardcreek.com or call 1-877-253-7690. Come visit us for a lifetime of memories.
This is Mark Danfoss, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Our special guest today is Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find Jim's website at 9/11 Scholars, plural, 911scholars.org. And among many fascinating things which you'll discover as you browse through the site is that Jim provides us with a link to an alphabetized list link to senior military intelligence and governmental officials who question the 9/11 Commission report. Take a look at the laundry list of people who are there. I trust you will know most of the names, if not all the names there. And when you look at the people listed on that site and who they are and what they're saying, it presents a picture that is very different from the kind of picture that you're going to get, certainly watching Fox News or reading the establishment publications, which I certainly try to read every day just to see what's in them. But the information presented to us by Jim Fetzer and Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which again you can find at 911scholars.org, gives us a disturbing composite of things that the government has not wanted us to know or even to consider that begins to smell a lot like what happened a generation ago with the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission report, or even going back farther than that. If one looks at the Pearl Harbor situation, get a copy of Robert Stinnett's book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, and look at the documents in that volume that were obtained by Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. It presents a completely different understanding of who and what was behind the 9/11, the Pearl Harbor situation that I think has some bearing on the way we might want to be perceiving 9/11 today as we begin to look at the evidence that is presented to us by people like Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett. And you can find that evidence again at 911scholars.org. I just wanted to warn Jim as well as our listeners that, of course, this is a time when we tend to have a number of frequent commercial breaks in the next 10 minutes, and then there will be a much longer period of time for extended conversation again. People can support the Republic Broadcasting Network by contacting us at republicbroadcasting.org or giving us a call at 1-800-724-2719. That's republicbroadcasting.org or giving us a call at 1-800-724-2719. You can also order Aaron Russo's new DVD, America, Freedom to Fascism, for $19.95 plus $4.95 shipping and handling. That's available again through contacting us on the World Wide Web at republicbroadcasting.org or at 1-800-724-2719. Jim, as I was saying, we're going to be interrupted a few times in the next 7 or 8 minutes with some frequent commercial breaks. But in regard to this whole business of 9/11, going back and forth, it seems to me, between the scientific evidence and the in an attempted political analysis of what happened, reminds me very much again of the Kennedy situation in regard to the going back and forth between issues of autopsies and ballistic evidence and mechanical firing time for rifles and things of this sort, to the larger questions of who may have been involved and for what purpose. pertaining not only to the Kennedy assassination, but now to 9/11. When we come back, let's examine a little bit of that. This is Mark Ankoff's America coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be back with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find that site again at 911scholars.org. Stay tuned.